No, I am used to the spotlight. Just another limiter.
Hi.
Okay. A very good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
You have to wake up. So, on behalf of our Chief Abbot, Bhante Dhammavasa, and all the resident monks of our temple, I would like to welcome all of you to this wonderful retreat with our beloved Buddhist monk and dearest Dhamma friend, Ajahn Brahm. This is the moment that we all have been looking forward to many days, thanks to our devotees, Dr. Pial and Dr. Indy, for taking all the pains in bringing Ajahn Brahm to Toronto.
Kidnapping.
Actually, it's not a pain. So you're much So, just a little while ago, I took some pictures with Ajahn Brahm in the front, and I said, Ajahn Brahm, everybody is dying for you. And he said, no, they should not be dying for me, they should be living for me. I said, they are living to die for you. So, it's always a great privilege to have Ajahn Brahm at our temple. And he has shown kindness to our temple in the past years by coming, visiting our temple, giving talks and conducting at our retreats at our new temple. And we always look forward to his presence at our temple. And as you know, Ajahn Brahm talks about the monkey method and the monk method. The banana. The monkeys know how to peel the bananas, right? So he says, like that, the monks and nuns know how to separate the mind from all the daily difficulties and problems. So for me, you know, I have listened to Ajahn Brahm's talks for many years, read all his books, and also read the sutras. And according to what I know, and Ajahn Brahm really knows the monk method. So we all are so happy to have him here, and it is our good karma too to have a wonderful monk in our presence. And it is a great blessing, as Buddha says, Samana Nancha Dasana Etam Mangal Mutta. It is a great blessing to have the presence of the monks. So it is our good karma, Ajahn Brahm. Thank you very much for visiting our temple. And I know they all are here to listen to you, not to me. So thank you, Ajahn Brahm.
You are doing well.
Thank you.
Very good. Okay, welcome to this one-day retreat. And it's good to be here. Nice to see you all. It's one thing being a Buddhist, but it's another thing actually practicing what the Buddha taught. So it's a great thing that those of you here are going to learn a little bit more about meditation and get to the heart of the teachings which liberate you from all types of suffering and problems. And sometimes that people think, oh, meditation is one thing and your life is a different thing. But the same attitude which you have towards meditation usually leads to a lot of success in your life. And those who have success in their life can use the same methods in their meditation as well, if it's real success. And that's one of the lovely things, that the two, your outside life and your meditation, they do work together. Can you hear okay? No. It's on here.
I think they will fix it.
They will fix it.
No, mic is off.
Okay, it's off. But it does not matter in the time of the Buddha. There were no mics. Never mind. It's okay. Another one. Very good.
Testing?
No. That doesn't work either. So, you saw the sign for this retreat, noble silence. I too will keep noble silence. When it starts working, let me know when it starts working. But in the meantime, we're here to meditate and to start off with, the Buddha taught two types of meditation. Who knows what those two types of meditation are? Aha, you fell into my trap. If I ask a question, you would do well to keep quiet. Everybody says that, but indeed there are one and the same type of meditation. And to make it quite clear, I tell the story of the couple in Toronto, Sam and Vi. Sam Atta and Vi Pasana. And they were both good Buddhists. And one day they decided after lunch to go and have a walk up Meditation Mountain. And so Sam and Vi went off for a walk and they took their little dog, Metta. So Sam and Vi and Metta the dog went up Meditation Mountain. Sam went up the mountain because it was so peaceful and still on top of Meditation Mountain. Vi, she went up there for the view. You could see for miles on the top of Meditation Mountain. And Metta the dog, she went up there just for the fun of it. Dogs are very wise. They just do it for fun. So Sam, Vi, and Metta the dog went up Meditation Mountain. When they got halfway up, it was so still that Sam was so happy how peaceful it was, even halfway up. And even halfway up, Vi could see for miles. And Metta the dog, she was wagging her tail. Yes, it is.
I'm only having you on.
Did you hear the simile so far? Very good. So even halfway up, Metta was very happy. When they got to the top of Meditation Mountain, it was so quiet, so still, that Sam, he was just so peaceful. The reason he got up to Meditation Mountain for the deep stillness had been achieved. But you know, Sam also had a pair of eyes. And he could see the view as well. Same with Vi. When she got on the top of Meditation Mountain, she too could see everywhere. She could see everything in the whole universe. The whole Dhamma was laid out before her. But she too could experience a deep stillness which existed on the top of Meditation Mountain. And as for Metta the dog, the Metta the dog could experience the stillness, could also see the huge view, and she was wagging her tail, because on the top of Meditation Mountain is stillness, incredible insights, and deep, deep happiness. So it doesn't matter why you walk up Meditation Mountain, for the joy, for the view, the stillness. All those three coexist on the top of Meditation Mountain. So there is no real difference between Samatha and Vipassana. That was the wrong answer to the question. What are the two different types of meditation? The correct answer is second noble truth meditation and third noble truth meditation. So what is the second noble truth? You listen to my first thing. Be quiet. you get into trouble. But it's true. The second noble truth is craving leads to suffering. So second noble truth meditation is craving, wanting something, desiring something, trying to achieve something. And what does that lead to? Suffering. Yeah. So for those of you who've meditated maybe for a year or more and you haven't had any peace, any stillness, any joy, you've only had frustration and disappointment, why? It is because you have been doing second noble truth meditation. It's leading to suffering. So, don't do that. Alternatively, we have third noble truth meditation. What's the third noble truth? Letting go of desire leads to the stillness of nibbana. So any of you who've had some success in meditation, your mind is peaceful and content and bright and still, you have been doing third noble truth meditation. Well done. I mention that because sometimes people take meditation, they forget all the other core teachings of Buddhism. And that is one of the core teachings, four noble truths. And if you understand that, if you are having frustration in meditation, it's because you're wanting something. If you let go of wanting, you'll find the mind becomes peaceful all by itself. And that is a great teaching of meditation. And the difficulty of meditation is that people approach meditation in the same way they approach passing their exams, going to work in the morning, building their house, or effort to get somewhere in the future. Meditation is a different thing. My teacher would always say, we meditate to let go, not to attain things. So anyone who's come on this retreat to attain someone, you're wasting your time, leave now. But if you come here to let go of things, not to attain but to let go, then you're coming on the right path. And there's a good chance you might achieve these things, but not when you want them. Now, what is meditation? Meditation is called stillness. Trying to move the mind into being still. Now, please, 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 never call meditation concentration. That's one of those very unfortunate translations from the word into English. It does not mean concentration. If it did, this retreat today would qualify as a concentration camp. Concentration is something I used to do at school because a teacher was standing over me, concentrate, concentrate. And it has very bad connotations. So what it really means is stillness. Is this water here?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Oh, empty.
Oh, it's amazing water. That is so profound. Can I have a bottle of water? I don't need a bottle of water to drink. I need it for my visual okay, Pierre, as you're in the front here, come up here. I need you as my assistant. Very good. So please pour water into the glass. Very good. Now, you can stand up, because I am now going to hold my cup of water perfectly still. I think I did this demonstration last time I was here. Now, Pierre, are you an honest man? Very good. So you will not exaggerate just because, you like me?
No.
Very good. So please tell the truth. I'm now going to hold this water perfectly still. Have I achieved my objective yet?
It's still moving.
It's moving. Okay. So what should I do? I will concentrate.
Still moving.
It's still moving. I could concentrate all day and the water would always be moving and I get tired and frustrated as a result. That is how many people meditate. And I said last night there's another way, which is Put it down. Now put it down. Now, PL, has it stopped moving yet?
Still moving a bit.
Very good. I was testing your honesty. Let's try it down on the floor. Okay. Put it down on something more solid. Do you have earthquakes in Toronto? That's better. Now.
Now it's still.
It's still. Perfectly still?
Yes.
Yes, perfectly still. A round of applause for my assistant. Now, I like that demonstration because it's something you can remember. Because that water represents your mind. And you can try for months, for years, trying to still your mind. And it never works. You get so frustrated and you think you can't meditate or meditation doesn't work. And that's a great shame because meditation does work if you know how to do it. Putting things down, letting things go. That is the heart of meditation. So we're not trying to attain something. We're not trying to go somewhere. We're trying to be here. Be here as much as you possibly can. And then you find the mind becomes still all by itself. So when we meditate, we learn how to, first of all, be with our bodies. Because if your body is aching and hurting, you'll find it so hard to meditate when you've got tummy ache, when you've got headache, when you get bottom ache, neck ache. There are so many aches possible in meditation. So first of all, when you sit down, you learn how to relax your body. And by relaxing your body, you can act, don't have to sit on the floor to meditate. You can actually sit on the seats in the back. In fact, all the people who manage to get the seats, you are so lucky. All you're sitting on the floor, unfortunate karma. And if you haven't got a place on the floor, the best seats in any Buddhist temple, the ones which fill up first of all, is the ones next to the wall or the pillar, so you can lean back. Very good. Because you have to learn how to get your body comfortable. So how do you do that? You have awareness of your body, and then you have kindness to your body. The awareness tells you how you're sitting, whether it's in a good position or not. And the kindness responds to how your body is feeling. If your body needs to be adjusted, you adjust it. If you need to scratch, you scratch. If you need to cough, you cough as soon as you can. Thank you. Because if you don't cough straight away, we have something in meditation we call the volcano effect. Someone has got an itchy throat, they decide to suppress it. And what happens? Just like a volcano, the pressure builds and builds and builds, and then the volcano blows up. Huge noise, and lava goes everywhere. That's what happens. I've seen that too many times in retreats. People try not to cough, and when they do cough, you can hear it upstairs and in the Presbyterian church next door. And you spray all this lava from your mouth all over the place. It's not a good idea. But it's also, you're missing the whole point of kindness. Just learn how to cough. Learn how to be kind to your body. And then it can relax. So when you meditate, first of all, you look after most of the body. And then, there are some feelings inside, maybe in your stomach, maybe headaches, some aches and pains or discomfort, which you can't get rid of by moving. So you focus on them with mindfulness. And you relax them with kindness. Kindness is what expands, takes the pressure off, loosens things up. You find that all the pain and tension is you're holding something very tight, like me holding the cup. When you put your body down, it relaxes with kindness. And you'll find your body does tend to go into a very nice state of relaxation. But once you have your body reasonably relaxed, you will, or you should be able to notice, a feeling of delight in your body. It's the same feeling of delight which people pay thousands of dollars for, to go to Miami, to go to Bermuda, to go to some resort in an exotic location in the world, where they can sit on these reclining chairs by the ocean and relax. That costs a lot of money. And usually by the time you get there, you're stressed out. By the time you get back and look at the bill, then you're doubly stressed out. And you can do it with no money at all at the Buddhist temple. You just learn how to relax the body. And when you feel the delight of relaxation, you will find the body starts to relax even more. The mind notices that this is a pleasurable experience, and you loosen up even more. I have found that once you notice the delight in the bodily relaxation, you actually get more relaxed. It's just what happens. And so your body feels really free and at ease and relaxed. That's not just as a physical preparation for meditation. Is also part of what's going to happen next when you learn how to relax your mental world. By relaxing the body, and many people can understand how to do that, you use exactly the same techniques to relax your mind. First of all, you try and notice all the tensions pulling you into the past because of some bad thing somebody did or said or what you did. It's like a tension, a string pulling you back. Or there's this other fear pulling you into the future. Now you have to make a decision about something really important. Your mind is under stress, being pulled by the past or the future. It's under pressure. You have to do something or make a decision about something. That is called mental stress. Just like you have the physical pains, the tensions and stress and pressures in your physical body. And so how do you overcome those tensions in the mind in precisely the same way? First of all, be aware of them, and then be kind to them, soften them. For example, you know, when you have a memory of the past, too many people try and get rid of it. I'm not supposed to be thinking of the past. Or you got some fantasy about the boy sitting next to you. You know, that happened once. I told that story last night about supermodels in retreats. I never mentioned that one of my disciples, a girl, went to go to Dharamsala in India to see His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And she went there for about 3 days. Every morning they had a morning meditation. And so she went there early, sat down in a seat, and started doing her meditation, just watching her breath come in and breath go out. And then she heard someone sit right next to her. Breath going in, breath going out. She just took a peek. Richard Gere coming in, Richard Gere.
It was Richard Gere.
She tried to watch her breath, but... No, come on. She's watching Richard Gere. But how we overcome sort of that mental... pressure, the mental tensions, is first of all, be kind to them. If you've got something happened in the past, be kind to it. It's just something which has to be, it's part of you. When you be kind to the past, whatever somebody said, maybe they were in a bad mood that day. Maybe you may have misunderstood what they really meant. Or maybe they weren't really talking about you anyway. And if you did something wrong which you still haven't forgiven, give yourself the benefit of the doubt. Whenever you think about the past and want to overcome guilt, remember guilt is the result of you judging the past as a prosecutor. You should be a defense attorney, not a prosecutor, and trying to get yourself off on a loophole. Instead of always being so guilty. So that's being kind to your past. And you find if you give some kindness to the past, just the way I give kindness to some pains in the body relaxes. And the pain and ache become less and less and less as I expand it, loosen it, And so it's very easy to let it go. Or sometimes it just disappears by itself. So if there's something bothering me from the past, I don't try and get rid of it. That's ill will. I'm kind to it. As I'm kind to it, it relaxes, the memory gets softer and softer. If it doesn't vanish by itself, it's easy to let it go. Fears of the future again. I don't try and get rid of any thoughts about the future. If I try and get rid of them, they get even stronger. I'm kind to them. And I'm kind to them and kind to them and kind to them. And then they don't bother me anymore. They disappear and vanish. The first of the great hindrances to meditation, the past and the future, are overcome not through force, not through willpower, but through kindness. That's why I call this method kindfulness, as I said last night. You come into this present moment, and if you just go off into the past and future again, why? Why is it that people can't stay here? It's not because you're not trying enough. Remember, if I hold that cup, it never becomes still. I have to let it go. So I'm kind to my mind. When I'm kind to my mind, it likes being with me, and it stays. That's one of the reasons why people have restlessness in the meditation. Well, they're always thinking, always doing stuff. Why is that? Sometimes I look, because part of Buddhism is not just fighting, it's understanding the causes of things. Why, you know, is restlessness here? And I came up with a simile of the two ladies going to the coffee shop in the afternoon. I don't know why it's two ladies going to the coffee shop, but I think it's because the husbands are working, paying for the coffee. But anyway, you know, you have a free afternoon, you get a call from one of your friends. Are you free this afternoon? You say, yeah, I'm free. So come to the coffee shop. And your friend says, now I know you like going to your coffee shop, but there's a new coffee shop opened in Toronto. I want to go there. And I know you like, you know, your short white or long black, because I don't go to coffee shops, I don't know what I'm talking about, but we're going to have a latte, because that's what I like. And you're going to have one too. And we're not going to have one of those biscuits. We're going to have a muffin, a blueberry muffin, because I love those blueberry muffins. And you're going to have one too. We're not going to sit there and talk about your stupid Buddhism. I'm interested in politics, so we're going to be talking about politics. And we're not going to sit out on the veranda. There's too many people there. I like sitting out in the back. I know you like the veranda, but I'm sitting in the back. You're going to sit there with me. And we're going to be there for 1.5 hours, because that's how much time I have, no less, no more. Now, if any person invites you out saying things like that, would you like to go? Who wants to be with a control freak? You suddenly come up with some excuse. I've just remembered. I've got to go to the dentist this afternoon. It slipped my mind. I'm terribly sorry. Maybe another time. Any excuse to get out of going to a coffee shop with a control freak. But as soon as they ring up, another friend rings you. Do you want to come out for a cup of coffee this afternoon? You say, I'm sorry, I've got a dentist appointment. Oh, that's a shame. Remember that coffee shop you were always talking about? I like to try that too. And you say the lattes, or the whatever it's, the cappuccinos there are to die for. You know, I like a cappo as well, I've never had one before. And you know, you're always talking about Buddhism. You know, I'm interested. Can you now tell me about this? I want to talk about what you want to talk about. And wherever you want to sit in the coffee shop, I'll sit there with you. Now, if someone is like that, you cancel your dentist appointment and go with them, because they're kind and they're interested in what you're interested in. You know, they're compassionate. And sometimes you go out with a cup of for a cup of coffee with someone like that, and you spend 3 hours there, and you come home late. Time flies when you're having fun. Now, the meaning of that simile is that some people meditate, and they tell their mind, right, we're going to do breath meditation. Not what you like to do, you can do what I'm not going to like to do. You're going to watch the breath go in, watch the breath go out, in the way I tell you to, and you are going to do this for 1 hour, not half an hour, not an hour and a half, 1 hour precisely. And you're going to sit cross-legged in full lotus, not that stupid posture which you normally sit on. You're going to do it my way. No wonder your mind runs away from you. As soon as it sees you coming, it starts to think about something else. Anything to get away. Sloth and torpor, restlessness, anything to escape from you, control freak. Now, I hope you understand that simile, because that's how your mind works. If you're kind to it, it stays with you. And if that simile doesn't work, there's a simile of this lady in Australia, in Perth. She told me that she had a six-year-old son, and one day, six-year-old son at home, school holidays, threw a tantrum. And it ended with the child saying, "Mummy, I don't love you anymore, I'm leaving home." And Mummy said, "Okay, darling, I'll help you pack." Now, many of your mothers have probably thought of that strategy, but this mother actually did it. She went into the kids' bedroom, had a little suitcase, and packed all the important things of life, like the teddy bear, Spider-Man pants, and all the other things which kids think are really essential. And before the kid left, Mummy said, "Before you go, darling, I'll make you a sandwich for your lunch." So made the kid's favourite sandwich, put it in a brown paper bag, and waved the kid off at the door. The kid, having a suitcase in one hand, brown paper bag with the lunch in the other hand, "Bye-bye, darling, have a wonderful life." And the little six-year-old walked to the end of the path, opened the gate, turned left, and went out to its life. Only 6 years of age. It got about 20 metres, 30 metres, turned around, because it was homesick. Turned around, opened the gate, walked down the path, the mother hadn't moved. "Welcome home, darling." Now that was a very smart mummy. She knows a six-year-old is not going to go away for that long. But she did not want to control her kid and make the torments or the problem any worse. Let the kid go, and it comes straight back to you. And that's like your mind. Let it go. If the mind says, "Bye-bye, control freak, I'm leaving home. I don't want to stay with the breath. I don't want to stay with the present moment. I don't want to stay with you at all. I'm going." Say, "Bye-bye, mind, have a nice time." And it will come back to you pretty quickly. The reason is because it likes your company. That is such an important message in meditation. If you try and control your mind will rebel, run away from you, and you'll never experience any peace in meditation. If you're kind to your mind, it may go away for a little while, but it will come back. Why? Because you and the mind are best friends. I'm a best friend of my mind. We've had such beautiful experiences together in the past. We're the best of mates. So when I close my mind and start to meditate, my mind says, "Oh, we're meditating now. Woohoo, yes. Yes, come on, let's get into it." Well, the Buddha said the mind leaps into the meditation because it likes it. So that's an important part. Don't control the mind. Be kind to the past, be kind to the future, be kind to the present. And it stays with you without effort. Let it be. If that doesn't work, the little method which I mentioned last night, which I'm going to elaborate on. Emperor's three questions. When is the most important time?
Now.
Now is where your future is being made. Now is also where your past is being made. Tomorrow, you'll remember this moment. This will be your past. Make now beautiful, happy, joyful, and have wonderful memories. It's also this moment is the only time you can create a future. So you put all the attention in this present moment. What? Who is the most important person?
The one in front of you.
The one in front of you, yes, thank you. Anyone who said themselves, get a copy of my talk last night. That's the wrong answer. And in meditation, it means the object right in front of your mind, that is the most important in the whole world. So if you are sleepy, that is the most important object in the whole world. Not nimittas, not jhanas, not breath or anything. The sloth and torpor is really important. Stay with it. If you have a thought in the mind, restlessness, that is the most important thing in the whole world for you, because it's happening now. The problem in meditation, people judge too much. And they think, no, they shouldn't be here, they should be in nimitta land or jhana land. anywhere else except this stupid tired old mind you have now. This tired old mind is important, it's valuable. Why? Because it's right in front of you. When you give importance to what you're experiencing now, you have mindfulness. When you try and get rid of what you're experiencing now, that's called the hindrance of ill will. When you try and want something in the future, yeah, I'll sleep. I want to be beautiful lights and blissing out and having the bliss better than sex, which Ajahn Brahm talks about in his book. That's what I want. That is desire. That's the first hindrance. You never get anywhere in meditation like that. You give importance to whatever it is right now, whatever. And then whatever is important in front of you, you're aware of, fully, not trying to get rid of it. And remember the last question for the Emperor's Three Questions. What is the most important thing to do?
Care.
Care to care for it. If you want to know what that really means, the old story of the disciple who was a doctor first year in the hospital as an intern. He'd grown up with me. He came to the temple when he was a really small boy. Now, first year as an intern, first patient passed away under his care. And it was a young mother, 24, 25. And even though he was not to blame, he felt so guilty. And he had to be the one who went to the husband to tell him he has no wife anymore, and to tell him his children had no mother. She died. And he said that was such a terrible, devastating thing to do that he said, I can't do that ever again. I can't be a doctor. I'd have to resign and have another career. He wanted to resign. And then, because imagine having to do that, telling the husband and the children, your wife, your mummy has died. It's devastating. But then I told him, look, your problem is you haven't understood the duty of a doctor. The duty of a doctor is not to cure people. If you think that's your job, to cure your patients, you are going to fail many, many, many times. Doesn't matter how much effort, how much skill you give, many of your patients will die and you'll feel a failure again. And it's not your fault, it's because you've got the wrong attitude. The duty, the main purpose of a doctor is not to cure, but to care. And if you care for the patients you're assigned, you never need to fail. You can't always cure them, but you can always care for them. And if they do die, they die having been cared for. What a wonderful way to go. And as many of you will know, if you care for somebody, the survival rate goes up. Not as many people die because of caring. I mention that because in meditation, you don't try and cure your mind of all its stupidity, its hindrances, its defilements and stuff like that. Stop trying to cure your mind. It doesn't work. Care for it. It's a total different attitude. So you've got a hindrance or something, care for it. Poor little hindrance. Every time you come in, I get angry at you and upset at you. You can come in now. Come on, hindrance. Come. Care for it. And when you have that attitude, now's the most important time. Whatever you're experiencing is the most important thing. Value it and care for it. Don't try and cure it. You'll find you get peaceful. You can stay in the present moment. And because you're peaceful, as I said last night, you soon become still. And because you become still, all these amazing things in meditation happen. When the mind becomes still, things vanish. One of the best books which I have written is The Art of Disappearing. Because it starts to give this meditation something which no one else has really pointed out, but it's right there in the suttas. That once you start to be in the present moment, relaxed, at peace, not wanting the past, not wanting the future, whatever's here right now, you're with, It means you stop doing things. You stop trying to make things happen. You're no longer controlling things. You're caring for them, accepting them, being with them. Which means your mind starts to become very, very peaceful. My teacher described this years ago, Ajahn Chah. He'd always be raising his hand and flapping it about. He didn't have Parkinson's. Actually, that's another thing. That people ask me, especially in the West, all these cultures and traditions which people do in Sri Lanka, in Thailand, you know, in Hong Kong and Malaysia, Singapore. Have you ever gone to any of these Chinese temples and seen people taking bundles of incense and shaking them before they put them in the pot? You don't do that in the Sri Lankan temple, do you? But Chinese temple, they do that a lot. And someone once asked me, why do they do that? At first I didn't know, but then I thought, I know where that came from. Because in a Chinese tradition, it's always a grandma takes the children to the temple for the first time. Almost like the same as Sri Lanka. Take your kid, your grandkids there. And grandma teaches the grandchildren what to do. And the grandchildren follow grandma. And so because grandma has got Parkinson's, she puts the incense into the container because she's got Parkinson's. And the grandchildren think that's what you're supposed to do. And they follow. And that's where that tradition came from. So anyway, where we come from. So the way you're in this present moment, Ajahn Chah, sorry, he's waving his hand up like this. And he said, this represents a leaf on a tree. Now in the days before PowerPoints, you have to make up your own PowerPoints. I already made one up with the glass of water. The second one, waving your hand. This is a leaf on a tree. It only waves up and down because of something external to itself, the wind. That's why it moves. If the wind stopped, the leaf would still move, but less and less, until it became perfectly still. Because that's the nature of the leaf, to be perfectly still. And Ajahn Chah would say, that's the nature of the human mind. Its nature is to be still. If you could only get out of the way, it would become still all by itself. Somehow or other, you've got to stop the wind. The winds of wanting. That's what makes your mind move. So by being in this present moment, whatever's in front of you is the most important. You don't try and get rid of it, you don't want anything else, and you care for it. That stops the wind, which makes the mind move, which stops it being still. So what happens? Just watching this present moment, soon you'll find your body disappears. It's not a problem anymore. It's relaxed. So you can't feel your hands. You can't feel your legs. You can't feel anything. It's vanished, except the last part of the body which is still moving. You're breathing. The breath meditation is not something you do. It's something which happens when you let go of other things. You don't try and watch the breath. You relax in the present moment, be really still with whatever's happening right now, care for it, and you find that soon you're aware of your breath. And the reason is because it's the only thing left to watch. It's breathing in and breathing out. That's why the breath meditation is a core technique. But you don't focus on it, that's too much effort. You don't try and watch it. That's too much control, which means you can't stay with it very long. You let it come to you. You relax, let go, and soon you notice all you're aware of, breathing in, breathing out. What do you do with that? That's the most important object in the world. Care for it. Nice breath. I sometimes look upon my breath and start thinking, you have been taking oxygen into my body ever since I was born and taking all these waste products out, even when I'm busy, when I'm asleep. All the time you've never failed me and I've never shown you any gratitude. Thank you, breath. for doing all this work, thanklessly often. So I look at my breath with a lot of kindness. Oh, you're just really a nice breath. You're my best friend. Or whatever. When I look upon my breath like that, of course, whatever you're kind to sticks with you. You don't force your attention onto the mind. It's the kindness, the kindfulness, makes it such an easy object to stay with. You stay with it for a long period of time. And just getting that far, you have a lot of peace and happiness. You're resting, you're not doing things, you're not trying to struggle to get somewhere. You're just being with things, this moment is important, not wanting anything in the future, not worried about the past, because you've been kind to let that go a long time ago, hanging out with your breath. What happens next? It's not something you do, because the breath becomes relaxed, because your body doesn't need much oxygen. The breath gets smoother, less and less and less, until the amount of breath you need is so small you can't notice it anymore. The breath disappears. Your body disappears first, then your breath. What's left? When the body's gone and the breath's gone, what's the other time in your life that the body disappears and you stop breathing? Death, yes. But this is not death, this is just rehearsal. Because your mind is still very bright. In fact, your mind is incredibly bright. A lot of the times, because the mind has two parts to it. The first part of the mind is called the active mind. We call it the doing mind, controlling mind. All the thoughts, the choices, the controlling, trying to get this, get rid of that. That is what consumes most of your mental energy. So much that you've hardly got anything left for the other part of the mind. Knowing. The passive mind, which can hear me, which can feel the body, which knows the nature of your mind and emotional world. That knower is usually so dull, simply because you've been wasting too much of energy in controlling, making things happen, getting rid of things. In this method of meditation, because you're not doing anything, you're not controlling, you're being kind, you're in this moment, giving importance to whatever you're experiencing right now, you'll find, because you're not doing anything, the mental energy starts to go into knowing, awareness, mindfulness. You are not creating mindfulness, you're empowering it, giving you a boost of energy. So much so that your mindfulness increases in intensity. What do I mean by that? You can see more, you can feel more, you can hear more deeply. The usual description is that people, they go outside and whatever they see, whatever they feel, even the food tastes richer. You can basically get more flavor out of it. At the recent rage retreat, Wassa in Perth, one of the ladies, she was from San Fran, a Chinese girl. She was sitting in the toilet after a really good meditation. There's nothing really to see in the toilet except the tiles on the wall. And then one of the tiles on the wall became the most beautiful tiles you'd ever seen in the whole world. Just an ordinary toilet tile became incredible. And she thought of cutting it out and taking it home with them. Now that is a common experience in meditation. Simple things start to look incredibly beautiful. Why? All it is because your awareness is getting heaps of power and energy, so much that whatever you see, whatever you feel, whatever you hear, becomes incredibly delightful. Many people will have the experience of meditating and be able to smell fragrant smells when they're meditating. And they think, is this some heavenly being? Is some new scent by the person sitting next to you? It's not. All it is your nose is becoming so sensitive that whatever you smell is actually delightful. It's a sign that mindfulness is getting empowered. And what happens in meditation is that once the mindfulness gets empowered, the last little bit of breath before it fades away is absolutely delightful. It's an ordinary breath, but because your mindfulness has increased, it's experienced as being lovely. Breathing, oh yeah, I can do this for a long time. The delightful breath stage is the stage where your mindfulness has increased in power, necessary to take it deeper into meditation. Stillness isn't static, because with stillness you're putting power into mindfulness. Mindfulness is getting stronger, you see more, you feel more, it's more and more delightful. That empowers the mind into meditation and into enlightenment. For those of you who don't know, the word Buddha does not mean enlightened one, it comes from the Pali word Pujjati, which means to wake up, the awakened one. What does that mean? Mindfulness, awareness, it gets power, incredible power. And you think you're awake now, ha ha ha. You get into some deep meditation and like you now are awake. You can see, you can feel deeply. So, that's what happens with stillness. And when you see this delightful breath, oh, this is really good. You have so much mindfulness that when that's so still, it vanishes. You see these beautiful lights come up into the mind. The sign of the last of the senses, the sixth sense, the mind, the citta. That's how you experience it. Beautiful lights in the mind. When people first get these, they think, oh my goodness, somebody is shining a flashlight in my eyes. It must be the sun. Today, if I close my eyes, I'll get lots of nimittas because of that light over there. But that's actually what it's like, you know, with your eyes closed, seeing a big light in front of you. Radiant, only much more radiant than that, and much more beautiful. That's why I said I don't mind being in the spotlight, because I'm used to nimittas. So, that's what it feels like. And of course, if that comes up, what do you do? Remember the method? Emperor's three questions? Now's the most important time. Forget what's going to happen next. If ever you think, what should I do next? You've lost the plot in meditation. Did you hear about those group of undertakers wandering around the cemetery in Toronto? They'd lost the plot. That's a joke. I'll explain it to you later. Group of undertakers wandering around the cemetery. They'd lost the plot. You know, the plot where they put the... Okay. But if you say just what am I supposed to do next? The very question is wrong. It's not what you're doing next, it's what you're doing now. So you're in this present moment. And whatever it is now, it's really important. And just care for this nimitta. Care for it. That's all. Don't try and control it. Care for it. Open the door of your heart to it. Let it be. And then it stays. Because it stays, it gets really still. What happens is it increases in its power. The energy of the mind goes into it, pours into it. And this light you see becomes brighter than the sun. More beautiful than anything you've ever seen before in your life. The bliss is sometimes more than you can take. But you can take it. And then it gets so strong. That's all that you can ever experience afterwards. It's just the sheer bliss. No light anymore. Just like you're enveloped. Dived in, your object of mind, to the bliss which you've never experienced before. You are now in the jhanas. Through stillness, through not doing anything, your leaf is now perfectly still. And it's not a boring state, not at all. You are really awake now, really empowered, really enjoying yourself. These are the jhanas. You get into a few of these jhanas and so on is unavoidable. You can't help yourself. The power of those experiences is just too great. I may explain later on this afternoon why, but you have a wonderful time and you get great insights, enormous insights as well. And people say, well, Ajahn Brahm, maybe monks and nuns can do this stuff. Even monks and nuns sometimes can't get the jhanas. But us, We just ordinary householders, what hope is there for me? About how many months ago? 8 months ago or something, teaching a retreat in Perth. And this guy came on my retreat. And he had long, curly hair, tattoos all over him. I thought he was like a Hell's Angels. Because there's a prison not far from our monastery. I thought he'd come to the wrong place. The prison's up the road over there where your friends are. And he said, no, I've come on this retreat. And my fault, judging. But then when they came on the interviews, he blew my mind. Because he started explaining his experiences. And it was a jhana. I thought, wow. Even such Caucasian Australian guys with tats all over him, even they can get these incredible states of mind. If they can, why not you? Is anyone with any tats here? Go out and get some more, it'll increase your chances. No, don't do that. But what it proved to me is that anyone can get these jhanas if they follow the instructions. But remember, the leaf never becomes still if the wind is blowing. If you want something, anything, even good things, you are disturbing your mind. So the whole path of meditation is letting go, putting things down, and watching the cup of water become still all by itself. Fascinating path. You do anything and it disturbs it. That's what meditation is. So, easy. Just sit there and don't do anything. Can you do that? No, you can't. You always get involved, don't you? Sometimes you're driving a car, you've got a GPS. And you tell the GPS, that's wrong, don't go there. And it's, stop getting involved. Let go. Sometimes you go and visit somebody's house. And the husband's telling the wife what to do, the wife's telling the husband what to do. And sometimes, why don't you leave each other alone? It doesn't matter if they do it right and do it wrong. And if they do it right, wonderful. If they do it wrong, blame them. Whatever, you don't have to get involved so much. Learn how to let go and be peaceful. If you can do that in meditation, you can do that in life. Learning how to let things be. And they heal themselves and they get very good. So that's meditation. That's the third noble truth, meditation. Letting go. And it leads to incredible states of stillness, happiness, and wisdom. So, that's the path. Now, the questions. Questions, comments, complaints about what I've just been saying, how to meditate. Most important thing, three questions now. I care for whatever is in front of you. Yes. You feel a lot, sorry?
Sleepy.
Okay, very good question.
You are not asleep, but you are aware, but then you are not conscious. So how do you cope with that state?
You let yourself sleep. Don't fight it, for goodness sake. Because sometimes people think that sleep is a bad state. And it's just like I said, whatever you're experiencing right now is important. Leave it alone. It's your body sort of coping with what doctors and psychologists call sleep deficit. At last you're out of the way. You're not controlling. You've not got all these jobs you have to complete. You're just meditating and the brain thinks, okay, I can now catch up. Let it be. Just be kind to the sleepiness. And it doesn't last that long. If you fight it, it lasts a long time. If you let it be, it doesn't last that long at all. But when it goes, you're very peaceful. In my meditation center, some of the chairs have got arms on them. Some have got, we're thinking of putting in seat belts. So people can fall asleep without any worries. It's sleep deficit, so just do it. And if that doesn't convince you, there is a sutra in the Samyutta Nikaya, I think. Oh no, it's in Majjhima. Anyway, somewhere. Where the Buddha is with his attendant, Ananda, they are walking through the forest and they see a monk meditating. Perfect posture, full lotus, straight back, right hand over the left hand, eyes closed, chin tucked in, meditating perfectly. And the Buddha turns around to Ananda and says, I'm worried about that monk. And 2 weeks later, that monk is disrobed. The same day, he goes deeper into the forest and sees another monk meditating, nodding this way, nodding that way. And the Buddha smiles to Ananda. I'm not worried about him. And 2 weeks later, that monk is fully enlightened with all the psychic powers. So if ever you fall asleep during meditation, remember that story, another 2 weeks. And the reason is, in that story, the first monk was control freak. Yeah, anyone can sit with a straight back in full lotus, even though it hurts like hell. You can do that. Out of willpower, conceit, showing off. That's not meditation. The other monk was letting go, not controlling, not even being embarrassed that his great teacher, the Buddha, was watching him. That's why he soon became enlightened. He was letting go. He was doing Third Noble Truth meditation. So if that comes up, sloth and torpor is a result of what we call old karma, tiredness. So you just have to bear with it for a while, and it passes. But if you make more bad karma by fighting it, the sloth and torpor will last a long time. Buddhism is a kind, compassionate religion. It's not a militaristic path. You don't fight things. You don't do battle with them. You don't make war. You make peace. It's incredible how powerful that is. Yes?
Is there a guideline of how long or how often you should meditate?
Yeah. You should only meditate for one moment. And how often? Always meditate now. This whole thing about time is this: time is a prison which we make for ourselves and our meditation. So sometimes people think they should beat their record. You know, you start off, you can do half an hour, and you feel so good when you can do 40 minutes. Oh yeah, I'll do 40 minutes now. Now I'm going to go for an hour. This is more what's called spiritual materialism. You know, seeing if you can beat your personal best. That's the wrong way. So that's one of the reasons why whenever I have a retreat, we always have a retreat with noble silence. You know what noble silence means in a retreat? We have no bells. No bell to start, no bell to finish. It's just like going to school again, trying to be controlled. A bell for lunch, a bell for going to sleep, a bell for getting up in the morning again. Because it drives you crazy. And especially because sometimes you're meditating and you have a really wonderful time, just about to get enlightened, and dong! And other times, you know, you're being tortured, going through hell. When is this going to finish? When is this going to finish? When is this going to finish? That happened to me. I went on these retreats when I was a layperson, and I saw the bell, this big gong, you know, next to the teacher. And I thought of getting a little stone or something and something gone and I could get up and leave. So we don't have any bells. So you meditate as long as you feel happy. And you keep it natural. And if you do it that way, it's amazing. You meditate longer. When you don't worry about time, you actually limit the duration of your meditation. And sometimes you push meditation when you should be coming out. You come out when you should be staying in. So forget about time. You have too much trouble with time at work. So that's noble pause. You know, because we have noble silence on our retreats, there's a few people every year win the Nobel Peace Prize. Can we get still? So thanks for that question. Another question, yes?
How do you handle fear in meditation?
Ah, and that's another really good question. Fear is going to come up again and again and again in meditation. This meditation is actually incredibly scary because you're letting go of things you've been attached to for years. It takes a lot of courage not to control. So much so that I described it to one lady in a retreat recently. It's like you're driving along in a car and you've got me in the passenger seat. It's in really busy traffic on the expressway. And I tell you, take hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals. That's scary to do that. If I don't control, we're going to crash. Take your hands off steering wheel, feet off pedals. That's what it's like in meditation. See what happens. Now, don't do that on the expressway when you're driving home, you know. But in meditation, do it. And this lady, she came to see me in the morning. She had this dream that she was in a car which was going out of control, careering over to a cliff. And she still had her hands on the steering wheel, trying to control the car, trying to put the brakes on. And I was sitting next to her in her dream. And I said, take your hands off the wheel, feet off the pedals. And she had enough confidence, she did. We both went over the cliff. But she saw as we were going down the cliff, there was a road at the bottom, but there's a really sharp right turn. But she said, okay, trust the teachings, hands off the steering wheel, feet off the pedals, and we careered down at top speed to the bottom. The car hit the bottom and by itself turned a perfect right corner and went along the road, perfectly safe, with no injuries. Well done. You know, in your dream, it just showed you that this is what meditation is all about. Have a bit of confidence. You're absolutely safe when you let go. The only reason why you control is out of fear. That's how governments control you. Make you afraid of something, first of all, and then have all these CCTV cameras around controlling. That's how you control. Afraid, then I control. Letting go takes courage, takes trust, a bit of faith. But when you do come across fear, fear is the cold face of insight. When fear comes up, it's a sign you're about to let go of something you've cherished for such a long time. Something is being taken away from you. Let it be taken away. You'll feel so much more freedom afterwards. And even the Buddha experienced fear. That's in the Ariyaparyasana Sutta. He said, why should I be afraid? I'm going to let go. So when fear comes up, it's all about letting go of something. So number one, well done. This is the birthplace of insight, the birthplace of letting go. So what happens? You'd be afraid. Sometimes you can't handle it. You come out. The next time, go a bit deeper, a bit further. And after a while, you go through that fear. You feel so peaceful. Later on today, I'll mention a bit more about fear. Later on today, we're going to do some walking meditation after lunch. The reason we do walking meditation after lunch, if you do sitting meditation, you fall asleep. Just all the blood goes to your tummy, especially the amount of food some of you eat. But anyhow, when you go to do walking meditation, a great way of doing walking meditation, you know, moving your left foot, right foot, is to do a mantra with the walking meditation. A group of words you say to yourself over and over again. And the best mantra is, it comes from a Thai tradition, but you have to say it in English. You say, when you move your left foot, the left foot moves, you recite to yourself, I will die. When you move your right foot, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. When you first start doing that, you laugh like you just had laughed a few moments ago. You think it's funny, it's a joke. But you keep on going, I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. You realize of all the teachings, religious truths in the whole world, that is something you can trust. Once you accept that, you come across fear. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. Keep on walking. Walk through that fear. Because once that fear has subsided, you feel so peaceful. The reason is because when you realize you will die, that's for sure, all your problems in life vanish. Divorce, money problems, health problems. You're going to die anyway. What's the point? So it means you let go. I will die, that's for sure. You walk through the fear, and on the other side, you have a lot of peace, a lot of freedom. That teaches you why fear is a barrier in meditation, in the religious life, we all have to go through. The sooner we get through it on the other side, it's such a beautiful experience. Okay, there's a question over here from the lady. Yeah. Nothing really. It's just we use words, you know, very loosely in Buddhism. You know, it's not some philosophy where we have to define everything very carefully. We use words as other people use them. So people sometimes say awareness, sometimes use mindfulness as a word. Keep it the same. As long as you're here in this moment and you're aware of what's going on in this moment, that's mindfulness. But remember, mindfulness has different levels of power. In meditation, you experience huge levels of power and mindfulness. So, you know, you really are aware. More aware than you've ever been before in your life. Yes?
If you're happy in life, like you have a good job, you have good friends, you have good food, like is this like a shallow type of happiness? Is this constructive for training mind to be happy, or this is good type of happiness?
This is like the person who's been in prison for 40 years. He's pretty happy in there. He gets good food, no worries, you can watch the TV if you're on good behavior. You know, you've got your own cell, you've got no mortgage to pay, nothing to worry you. And then you find out tomorrow you're going to be released from jail. If you notice how many people who are in a situation like that prefer to stay inside, they don't want to be released, they're afraid of getting out. It's worthwhile getting out. After a while they realize outside those prison walls there's much more freedom, much more happiness, much more joy and meaning in life. So sometimes what we're attached to becomes our prison. We think about that that's all there is, and when we actually leave, it's a bit scary. But you carry on leaving, get out of the prisons you make in life, and afterwards you find, wow, why did I think the prison was such a wonderful life? Escape. That's why people keep telling me, said, you monks, you're escaping from real life. I said, yes, you've got it. I'm escaping. Come with me. It's wonderful outside. Some other people, they look at me and say, Ajahn Brahm, you went to a great university. Now what have you got? What assets have you? You got a house, you got money for your retirement, you got a healthcare plan. I said, no. I said, Ajahn Brahm, you had such potential, you're a loser. When they call me a loser, yes, thank you for that wonderful compliment. Because you know who the... Apparently you don't have this show in Canada, do you? The biggest loser? You do. Who is the biggest loser? The Buddha. He lost everything. He lost all his defilements, all his suffering, all his unhappiness. I present to you the biggest loser. So if you're a loser, well done, just like me. Let go of as much as you can and be a loser. You know, people who are supposed to be winners, if you win some, you have to defend it next year. So much stress being a winner. And I tell this to kids, and their parents hate me for saying this. I say, look, kids, if you pass your exams, do you do O-levels and A-levels here? No, what do you do? You do like the American system, grades 6, 8, and 10. Look, suppose you do, you know, your university entrance exam and you pass. What happens next? You've got another exam next year. And you have to keep doing more exams until you fail one. If you fail one now, then you're free. You don't have to do any more. Woohoo! Otherwise, it's always another exam next year every time you pass. It's endless. So, fail now and be free. Ooh, they hate me for that. It's true, isn't it? All you people who want to advance your career. Do you really want to advance your career? To me, that's totally dumb. Look, if you get a promotion, you get more money, okay? But have you got enough money yet, now? No. Hands up if you've got too much money. Proven. So, in the job you're doing now, you haven't got enough money. If you get a promotion, you get more money, but it's still not enough. And you have more stress, more responsibility. Haven't you got enough stress already? Yeah, so stop wanting the promotion. Be a loser. And they're happy and peaceful. And be happy with the not enough money you have now. Rather than not enough money when you're rich. It's always not enough. So that's my thing. Yes, don't need to sort of get on in the world. Get on in happiness instead. I am bad for the economy. But good for happiness. The other thing which I was... this Christian came up to me about 3 months ago and he trying to convert me and said, nothing is better than God. That's what they said to me. And I said, sadhu, 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 I agree with you absolutely, totally. Nothing, emptiness, is much higher than your God. So I agree with you. Nothing is better than God. Nothing is superior to Jesus. So what do I believe in? Nothing. I worship nothing. I own nothing. The art of disappearing, being a loser, worshipping nothing. And they can't take it away from you. They can't take nothing away from you. So, okay, I think that's enough questions. We're going to meditate now. Okay, so out of kindness and compassion for everybody, I am going to stand up.